this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For the thousands, yes, the hundreds of thousands of letters which you were responsible for sending to Congress this last month, permit me, in the name of Father Coughlin and social justice, to thank you. Taking advantage of your constitutional right of petition, you instructed your congressmen not to pass any law that would put America in the blood business. Success has crowned your efforts in the House of Representatives. May even greater success be yours in the Senate this week, when the so-called neutrality bills come up for consideration. Today's presentation marks almost the eve of the 4th of July. Recognizing that religion and its practice are almost impossible without liberty, and also recognizing that under our republican form of government, we in this country are blessed with liberty, Father Coughlin has deemed it fitting that no better use could be made of this hour today than to read for you the Declaration of Independence, around which all the glories of the 4th of July are concentrated. Following this reading, then your spokesman will read for you portions of George Washington's farewell address, an address immortalized for its thoughts on the ethics of a third term for any president, and for its sound advice to all Americans of their attitude towards those who, even under the fiction of progress, attempt to change our Constitution. Ladies and gentlemen, have you copies of these two immortal documents in your home? If not, please write to Father Coughlin this week, and he will mail to you a copy of the Declaration of Independence and a copy of George Washington's farewell address. Before inviting Father Coughlin to approach the microphone, may I announce the following. Agents are going around pretending to represent Father Coughlin in the sale of religious articles. No person is so authorized to represent either Father Coughlin or the Shrine. And second, daily broadcasts commenting on the news are being conducted by Social Justice Magazine, both in the Detroit and Chicago areas. Next Sunday, Father Coughlin will pursue his defense of Christianity and Americanism. Meanwhile, if it is your pleasure to retain Father on the air during the summer months, please extend to him your support for the continuation of these broadcasts and the progress of Social Justice Magazine, which obtains no revenue, as you know, from advertising copy. And now for the Declaration of Independence, as Father reads the 27 indictments, try to visualize if there is a parallel existing today. Father Coughlin.
My friends, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted amongst men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to effect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused to assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions from within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of land. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of the legislature. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined the others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, or protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, or depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, or transporting us beyond sea to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our government, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever, he has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and poverty, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hand. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned our redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of our free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. We must, therefore, acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind. Enemies in war, in peace, friends. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress, assembled, appealing to the supreme judge in the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortune, and our sacred honor. Thus, my friend, reads the immortal Declaration of Independence. And now for a summation of George Washington's farewell address to the people of the United States, which reads as follows. Friends and fellow citizens, the period for a new election of a citizen to administer the executive government of the United States being not far distant, and the time actually arrived when your thoughts must be employed in designating the person who is to be clothed with that important trust, it appears to me proper that I should now apprise you of the resolution I have formed to decline being considered among the number of those out of whom a choice is to be made. I beg you at the same time to do me the justice to be assured that this resolution has not been taken without a strict regard to all the considerations appertaining to the relation which binds a dutiful citizen to his country, and that in withdrawing the tender of service which silence in my situation might imply, I am influenced by no diminution of zeal for your future interests, no deficiency of grateful respect for your past kindness, but am supported by a full conviction that the step is compatible with both. The acceptance of and continuance hitherto in the office to which your suffrages have twice called me have been a uniform sacrifice of inclination to the opinion of duty and a deference for what appeared to be your desire. Satisfied that if any circumstances have given peculiar value to my services, they were temporary. I have the consolation to believe that while choice and prudence invite me to quit the political scene, patriotism does not forbid it. That is George Washington on the ethics of a third term. And now listen to the father of our country relative to the Constitution, to foreign entanglements, and to our duties. His words are these: to the efficacy and permanency of your union, a government for the whole is indispensable. Sensible of this momentous truth, you have improved upon your first essay by the adoption of a constitution of government for an intimate union and for the efficacious management of your common concerns. This government, completely free in its principles, is the distribution of its powers, uniting security with energy, and containing within itself a provision for its own amendment, has a just claim to your confidence and your support. Respect for its authority, compliance with its laws, acquiescence in its measures, are duties enjoined by the fundamental maxims of true liberty. The basis of our political system is the right of the people to make and to alter their constitutions of government. But the Constitution, which at any time exists, till changed by an explicit and authentic act of the whole people, is sacredly obligatory upon all. All obstructions to the execution of the law, all combinations and associations, under whatever plausible character, with the real design to direct, control, counteract, or all the regular deliberation and action of the constituted authorities, are destructive of this fundamental principle and of fatal tendency. Towards the preservation of your government and the permanency of your present happy state, it is requisite not only that you steadily discountenance irregular oppositions to its acknowledged authority, but also that you resist with care the spirit of innovation upon its principles, however specious the pretext. I have already intimated to you the danger of parties in the states, with particular reference to the founding of them on geographical discrimination. Let me now take a more comprehensive view and warn you in the most solemn manner against the baneful effects of the spirit of party generally. He is speaking of political parties. The alternate domination of one faction over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge natural to party dissension, is itself a frightful despotism. The disorders and miseries which result gradually incline the minds of men to seek security
and repose in the absolute power of an individual. And sooner or later, the chief of some prevailing faction, more able or more fortunate than his competitors, turns this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. Without looking forward to an extremity of this kind, the common and continual mischiefs of the spirit of party are sufficient to make it the interest and the duty of a wise people to discourage and restrain it. Partyism serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, kindles the animosity of one part against another, foments occasionally riot and insurrection. It opens the doors to foreign influence and corruption, which find a facilitated access to the government itself through the channels of party passions. It is important that the habits of thinking in a free country should inspire caution in those entrusted with its administration to confine themselves within their respective constitutional spheres, avoiding, in the exercise of the powers of one department, to encroach upon another. The spirit of encroachment tends to consolidate the powers of all the departments into one, and thus to create, whatever the form of government, a real despotism. In the past words, my friends, the father of our country was much alarmed over the possibility of the growth of political partyism. And finally, he was more alarmed over the attempt on the part of either the executive, the judiciary, or the legislative branch of government, assimilating the powers which belong to the other two branches. He continues, if in the opinion of the people, the distribution or modification of the constitutional powers be in any particular wrong, let it be corrected by an amendment in the way which the Constitution designates. But let there be no change by usurpation. Although this, in one instance, may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable support. And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. There's Washington for the communists. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar structure, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principles. And now, to conclude this portion, the father of our country tells us, observe good faith and justice towards all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all. The nation which indulges towards another an habitual hatred or an habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. It is a slave to its animosity or to its affection, either of which is sufficient to lead it astray from its duty and its interest. against the insidious wiles of foreign influence, the jealousy of a free people ought to be constantly awake. Since history and experience prove that foreign influence is one of the most baneful foes of republican government, excessive partiality for one foreign nation and excessive dislike for another cause those whom they actuate to see danger only on one side and serve to veil even the arts and influence of the other. The great rule of conduct, therefore, in regard to foreign nations is, in extending our commercial relations, to have with them as little political connection as possible. So far as we have already formed engagements, let them be fulfilled with perfect good faith. Here, let us stop.
Ladies and gentlemen, in just a moment, Father Coughlin will return to the air with his thought for the week.
Father Coughlin's address is coming to you as a presentation on your dial at 1250 kilocycles. WHBI Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, during the first half hour, it was my pleasure to read for you the immortal Declaration of Independence. Following that, I subjoin a summary of George Washington's farewell address, thinking that both these immortal documents were most appropriate for this, the eve of the birthday of our national independence. A summary of what I read relative to George Washington's farewell address may not be out of place. Once more I shall refer to his words. Once more I hope that my voice at this late date shall add some influence to all my fellow Americans and to our Congress in observing the precepts, the principles, and the philosophy which motivated the mind and the soul of the father of our country. It were a mockery were this 4th of July celebrated, unless it were in harmony with the spirit of the Declaration of Independence and with the spirit of the father of our country, who bequeathed to us in parting from the chair in the original White House his message as a guide for our future happiness. This message of George Washington, summarized, begins as follows, and it is most appropriate that in these days we remember this admonition. Washington said that he begged his compatriots not to insist that he occupy the chair in the White House for a third term. Already he had served two terms as president. And after much petitioning that he should resume office, he said, "I beg you at the same time to do me the justice to be assured that this resolution, namely the resolution to betake himself to private life, has not been taken without a strict regard to all the considerations appertaining to the relation which binds a dutiful citizen to his country, and that in withdrawing the tender of service, which silence in my situation might imply, I am influenced by no diminution of zeal for your future interests, no deficiency of grateful respect for your past kindness, but am supported by a full conviction that this step is compatible with both. My friends, no commentary is required upon this noble statement coming from the lips of our first president, the father of our country. He was not so important, so he thought in his humility, to occupy the chair in the White House for a period continuing beyond the second term. Following this introduction to his farewell address, the father of our country then admonished us to preserve the unity of our country. His words in giving us this admonition are as follows: to the efficacy and permanency of your union, a government for the whole is indispensable. That phrase, my friends, for the whole, is most remarkable. The philosophy that expressed Washington's ideas in this phrase runs counter to the philosophy that we should erect a capitalist government, a manufacturer's government, a laborer's government, a proletarian government. His words, I repeat, are these: to the efficacy and permanency of your union, a government for the whole is indispensable. And he continues by saying, sensible of this momentous truth, you have improved upon your first essay by the adoption of a constitution of government for an intimate union and for the efficacious management of your common concerns. In citing these words, my friend, the father of our country informs us that we have adopted a constitution of government to preserve our intimate union and to bring about an efficacious management of our common concern. In a few moments, he will refer to that form of government which is ours as a republic. Washington did not use the word a democracy, for a democracy in its modern meaning means that the people are the government and that the majority of votes emanating from the people establish right or establish wrong, establish law and establish order. According to the father of our country, the majority of the people do not necessarily constitute what is right or wrong. Because we have adopted a constitution of government for an intimate union and for the efficacious management of our common concerns. A constitution which, in a moment, he will tell us, must be respected by the president, by the representative, by the judiciary, and by the people themselves until that constitution is legally changed by the people. Continuing with George Washington's words, he warns us that respect for its authority, compliance with its laws, acquiescence in its measures, are duties therefore enjoined by the fundamental maxims of true liberty. The basis of our political system is the right of the people to make and to alter their constitution of government, but the constitution which at any time exists, till changed by an explicit and authentic act of the whole people, is sacredly obligatory upon all. My friends, as we pause to take inventory of our glories on this eve of the 4th of July, let us remember this Constitution to which the father of our country referred, and let us remember the counsels which he gave to us in respect to it. Then the father of our country continues by saying, all obstructions to the execution of laws, all combinations and associations under whatever plausible character, with the real design to direct, control, counteract, or awe the regular deliberation and action of the constituted authorities, are destructive of this fundamental principle and a fatal tendency. One would think, my friend, that Almighty God had given the gift of prevision to the father of our country. Today there are those organizations in our midst which, under some plausible character, pretend that they are struggling for liberty for the masses. But in reality, they are struggling to gain control over government. They are struggling to counteract and awe the regular deliberation of action of the constituted authorities. And they are a fatal tendency towards the preservation of your government, continues Washington, and the permanency of your present happy state. It is requisite not only that you steadily discountenance irregular opposition to its acknowledged authority, but also that you resist with care the spirit of innovation upon its principles, however specious the pretext. Many years ago, when Washington was leaving the White House, at the end of his second term, he warned us that it is our duty to resist with care the innovation of these communists, the innovation of these Nazis, the innovation of these spreaders of fascism, the innovation of these groups and organizations which are endeavoring under some veiled pretext to set up a form of government contrary
to our form that was born, I might say rather conceived, in the Declaration of Independence, the 4th of July. The father of our country then continued, I have already intimated to you the danger of parties in the state, with particular reference to the founding of them on geographical discrimination. Let me now take a more comprehensive view and warn you in the most solemn manner against the baneful effects of the spirit of party generally. My friends, in the Constitution of the United States, nothing whatsoever is said favorable to the present existence of political parties. On the contrary, the father of our country, who understood so well the nature of the Constitution of the United States, warns us solemnly relative to the dangers of partyism established on geographical grounds, and warns us just as comprehensively on the dangers of partyism generally. Here is what he says in particular. The alternate domination of one faction over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge that is natural to party dissension, is itself a frightful despotism. Those are strong words employed by the father of our country relative to this type of partyism, the alternate domination of which come not as a benediction upon the people, but rather as a blight and as a step toward despotism. And his words continue with these. The disorders and miseries which result gradually incline the minds of men to seek security and repose in the absolute power of an individual. And sooner or later, the chief of some prevailing faction, or political party, I may add, more able or more fortunate than his competitors, turns this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. My friends, in reading over the history of constitutions, in endeavoring to summarize the history of so-called partyism or democracy, no such statement is contained in all the pages of that history equally strong as that which I have just read from George Washington's farewell address. In brief, he says that if there are disorders in the country, and if these disorders are a constant, and if the only inconstant thing is the succession of one party following the other, the time will come when partyism will degenerate into dictatorship. For men eventually, says he, will gradually select one man and repose in that one man absolute power. And sooner or later, the chief of some prevailing faction or party, a chief more able and more fortunate than his competitors, turns this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. There, my friends, is a lesson
coming from the father of our country in these days when his words and his warning appear to be on the verge of fulfillment. Then he adds, relative to partyism, political partyism, this serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms. It kindles the animosity of one part against another. It foments occasionally riot and insurrection. It opens the doors to foreign influence and corruption, which find a facilitated access to the government itself through the channels of party passion. Those are George Washington's words. How does foreign propaganda insinuate itself within the folds of our patriotism? How does foreign influence come like a thief from the night to find refuge within our shores? Washington had an answer for that. And his answer is this, that when two political parties are fighting each other as if they were the bitterest enemies, then the foreigner, coming with his 30 pieces of silver, approaches one of the political parties with money, with influence, to gain the ascendancy over another political party. Thereby, the foreigner gains influence in our country. The father of our country continues with these words. It is important that the habits of thinking in a free country should inspire caution in those entrusted with its administration to confine themselves within their respective constitutional spheres, avoiding the exercise of the powers of one department to encroach upon the other. In these words, my friend, if you permit me to comment upon them, the father of our country insists that the presidential authority will not encroach upon the congressional authority, and that both the presidential and congressional authorities will not encroach upon the judicial authority. There are three separate, distinct branches of government set up in the United States of America as checks and balances upon each other, and if this America of ours is destined to last the storms and vicissitudes of fortune, then we must not permit the executive to influence the Congress, nor the Congress or executive to influence the judiciary. Washington says in conclusion about this spirit of encroachment, the spirit of encroachment tends to consolidate the powers of all departments into one, and thus to create whatever the form of government, a real despotism. Those are his words. And now, relative to a change in the Constitution of the United States, the father of our country has the following to say. If in the opinion of the people, the distribution or modification of the constitutional powers be in any particular wrong, let it be corrected by an amendment in the way which the Constitution designates. But, adds he, let there be no change by usurpation.
forego this in one instant may be the instrument of good. Usurpation is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. Therefore, my friends, commenting upon his words, even though our Constitution be rigorous today to such an extent that it imposes hardships upon us, let no president, let no Congress, let no Supreme Court change that Constitution, or if it must be changed, we the people will change it according to the rules set down within the Constitution. That is Washington's advice. An advice which does not sit kindly upon the ears of any person favoring usurpation. The father of our country continues, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable support. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to support these great pillars of human happiness, these foremost props of the duties of men and citizens. My friends, in these days when religion is looked upon askance by some, in these days when religion is cast into disrepute by others, in these days when the communist stands upon his rostrum to declaim to the world that religion is the opium of the people, I maintain that they are an American who do these things, and I maintain that they are running counter to the spirit of the father of our country. His words again, religion and morality are indispensable supports. They are not only supports, my friends, they are indispensable supports. Therefore, George Washington adds these words, let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar structure, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion to religious principles. George Washington was never canonized by his fellow religionists as a saint. George Washington was never ordained to the ministry in any church. Nevertheless, no one in the entire history of government and of civilization ever spoke truer words for the progress and prosperity of a country than did this the father of the United States of America in the words which I have just read. He concludes by saying, observe good faith and justice towards all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all. Religion and morality enjoins this conduct. I wonder if we cultivate good faith and justice towards all nations, or do we cultivate good faith and justice towards those nations that have torn religion down from the tabernacles and characterized it as the opium of the people. Washington adds, the nation which indulges towards another in habitual hatred or an habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. Have we a habitual hatred towards any nation today? Have we an habitual fondness towards any nation today? If so, are we a slave? He continues, that nation is a slave to its animosity or to its affections, either of which is sufficient to lead it astray from its duty and its interest. And finally, had I time, I should read the entire document to you. Time does not permit. I will be glad to mail you a copy with a commentary. The last portion of George Washington's farewell address tells us that Europe has a set of primary interests which to us have none or a very remote relation. Hence, Europe must be engaged in frequent controversies, the causes of which are essentially foreign to our concerns. Hence, therefore, it must be unwise in us to implicate ourselves by artificial ties in the ordinary vicissitudes of Europe's politics or the ordinary combinations and collisions of her friendships and enmity. Why, therefore, asks he, why forego the advantages of so peculiar a situation? Why quit our own to stand on foreign ground? Why, by interweaving our destiny with that of any part of Europe, entangle our peace and our prosperity in the toils of European ambition, or rivalship, interest, humor, and caprice? These are the words with which I close. God bless you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. Statements made and views expressed on this program are made on the sole responsibility of the sponsor and do not reflect the views of this station, its management, or personnel. Father Coughlin's address came to you as a presentation on your dial at 1250 kilocycles.